So good morning. Welcome to the regularly scheduled open session of the District of Columbia Board of Pharmacy. Today is our monthly meeting. Today's June 1st, 2017. We'd like to call the meeting to order by first having members of the board and staff members introduce ourselves. And then we will ask you as members of the public to introduce yourselves. Please make sure you sign the roll before you leave. And if you are affiliated with any organization, please state that as well in addition to your name. So welcome once again. I'll start things off. I'm Daphne Bernard, board member.
Tamara McCants, board member.
Good morning, Alan Friedman, board member.
Benjamin Miles, board member.
Staff present.
Good morning, Shauna White, executive director.
Good morning, Corinne Barron, health license specialist.
Good morning, Lawrence Holland, investigator.
Good morning, Carla Williams, board counsel.
Thank you. And so now we'll actually have members of the public. We'll start on this end. If you don't mind, state your name. Again, if you're affiliated with any organization, state that as well, and then sign the roll.
Okay. My name is Galita Nation. I'm a fourth-year doctor of pharmacy candidate from Howard University.
Hi, everyone. Joining. I'm Ashton Johnson. I'm also a fourth-year candidate of doctor of pharmacy program at Howard University.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Ellie LaParn. I'm a legal intern at American University.
Don Zalar, public.
Good morning, Carolyn Price, president of the Washington, D.C. Pharmacy Association.
Good morning, I'm Charlene Fairfax, I'm a senior pharmacist with the Department of Healthcare Finance.
I'm Kim Greenwood, I'm a registered nurse from downstairs with the Department of Health Immunization Program.
Hi, Jennifer Thomas, I'm with Del Marva Foundation, the Quality Improvement Organization for the district.
Good morning, my name is Clausen Frimpold, I'm an uprising T2 at Howard University College of Pharmacy.
Brian Luton from Safeway Pharmacy.
University of District Pharmacy Manager, Safeway Pharmacy.
Anne Boston Padua, Kaiser Permanente.
Eugene Nashmabadi, Kaiser Permanente.
Good morning, Jimmy Phillips from Walgreens.
I'm Molly Havern, Walgreens.
Good morning, Cindy Lowry, Walgreens.
Thank you. And so we will start off by having approval of the open session meeting minutes from our May 4th meeting. So board members, if you've had an opportunity to review those minutes, and when you're ready, we will entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, I move that the board approve the public session minutes from the May 4th meeting.
Is there a second?
Second.
Any discussion? Is there general consensus in favor of the motion?
Yes.
All right, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Abstentions? The motion carries. The next item on our agenda is the Executive Director's Report. Dr. White.
Good morning, everyone. For our statistics, currently we have 758 pharmacy technicians registered. We have 165 pharmacy technician trainees. We have 604 pharmacy interns. We have 1,855 pharmacists, and of those pharmacists, 506 have vaccination and immunization authority. We have 1,140 pharmaceutical detailers registered, and we have 7 of pharmacy technician training programs registered.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. Next on our agenda is the Assistant General Counsel's report. Thank you. So next we'll actually entertain the report of our subcommittees, beginning with our Legislative and Regulatory Subcommittee. Mr. Friedman.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning. Good morning.
The Legislative and Regulatory Subcommittee met last month, and we addressed 4 topics. First, naloxone. Second, Board of Pharmacy oversight for certain lab personnel. Third, board oversight of drug detailers, and fourth, an ongoing regulatory review process. So I'd like to walk everybody through those 4 areas. First of all, let's talk about naloxone. So as you know, the District of Columbia Council passed legislation on November 18th, I think it was 2016, related to pharmacists being able to provide naloxone. And this legislation actually does allow limited prescription authority for pharmacists. Pharmacists, as well as physicians, are defined as healthcare professionals. And There's a couple ways that naloxone can be provided. One, obviously, by prescription by a physician, but then also by a standing order by a pharmacist, which is not patient-specific. And the naloxone can be provided to either a person at risk of experiencing an opioid-related overdose or a family member, friend, or other person in a position to assist the person at risk. And the pharmacist does not need to go through any special training if they dispense relative to a prescription from a physician. However, if they're going to prescribe based on a standing order, then the pharmacist must complete a training conducted by the Department of Health. And the frequency of that training can be decided by the Department of Health through rulemaking. The training must include certain areas: how to screen a patient, how opioid antagonists operate to stop an opioid-related overdose, when the administration of an opioid antagonist is medically indicated, how to properly administer an opioid antagonist, and then certain circumstances where the opioid antagonist may be contraindicated, precautions, warning, and potential adverse effects. Anytime that the pharmacist either prescribes and or dispenses the opioid antagonist, they also are required to provide education and training to the patient. And again, there are very specific areas, six of them, that the pharmacist must counsel the patient on. And they're very similar to those that I just mentioned. The legislation provides protection from civil or criminal liability under certain circumstances, obviously not where there's reckless abandon or gross negligence. So the committee talked about how to go about fulfilling the requirement of the legislation. And what we decided to do was essentially to build a CE program. And we're going to invite community stakeholders who are interested to be part of that conversation. We talked about potentially partnering with Howard to actually get the CE, but we're interested also in perhaps working with the Center for Rational Prescribing, because we know there's already a model set up for that, and partnering with GW and certainly inviting them to be at the table as well. So if there are any pharmacy organizations, associations, pharmacy stakeholders that want to be a part of that, we will reach out both through the email distribution VIP list that Shauna uses. Also, I think we will publish formally in the register that we'll have a work group formed, and for anybody that would like to be part of that, they're certainly welcome to join. And then again, the purpose of that will be to develop the training. We anticipate that be ACPE training, and the recommendation from committee at this point is that the training occur one time. So for pharmacists, they take the training once, they can then prescribe the naloxone, okay? And I think that's the report for naloxone. Committee members, anything else to add?
I just want to add that we should be very excited about this, because this is like the small opening to begin pharmacists prescribing. So we really want to be excited as a pharmacy community and really get on board with this and really take this as an opportunity to show DC what pharmacists can do in the prescribing realm.
Great point.
Alan, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Down to water.
Mm-hmm.
You said that they'll be able to prescribe via a standing order, right?
Yeah.
So to acquire, so to speak, a standing order, you go through the training, but does a person have to give you a standing order, or do you get a standing order by going through the training?
That's a really good question. In our neighboring jurisdictions, there are standing orders created by the state. And so the drug name, the agreed upon directions are already there, and the standing order is actually issued by a medical director for the state. So we have one in Maryland, one in Virginia, for example. So it's sort of a preset template. The legislation really doesn't get into that detail here. So Carla, my assumption is that, well, let me not assume, what's your advice about how to then provide a standing order, technically speaking, for the pharmacist to use?
It would not come from the trainer. It would come from a physician.
OK. come from a physician. So would that be that a pharmacist would partner with one or more physicians and basically prescribe under that standing order agreed upon between the two parties?
Could be.
Okay. Could that be something we would embed in the regulation, or does the regulation only address training?
I think we would probably try to clarify through the regulation.
Okay, I think that'd be a good idea. So probably we would clarify within the regulation how one should and could be using a standing order to prescribe.
Okay.
Okay.
So just a quick comment.
Sorry, your name is in...
Sure, I'm Miriam Sood from Safeway Pharmacy.
Okay.
So I know yesterday they had a press release in the city of Baltimore where they're now even, they used to do with a standing order.
Right.
They got rid of the standing order, anyone that's properly trained walk in and be able to, patient can walk in and be able to get the naloxone. So I know in the past the standing order was issued by the Department of Health. That just made it easier, I think, from a standardization perspective for any community pharmacy to participate.
Right.
So that if you have different physicians, then you get into trouble of different private protocols, different collaboration, just my opinion.
Yeah, so the city of Baltimore is very interesting, and they've always been very progressive as opposed to the rest of the state. In Maryland, for those of you that are not familiar, there are or were training, well, there still are training requirements outside of Baltimore to actually participate. This is for the consumer who actually wants to get the naloxone. So they're trying to expedite and do away with that. But my understanding for what they're doing in Baltimore is essentially creating, saying that naloxone is OTC, and they even can just walk in and get it. And I'm not so sure that that interpretation flies, because if naloxone is a prescription product, no state jurisdiction can supersede the FDA and say it's an OTC product. But to have a pharmacist furnish it under a standing order and protocol certainly is allowable. So I have to go back and look at the Baltimore piece, because I know they've created some flexibility, and I thought it was just getting rid of the training piece.
Right, and there is, even with that, you still have a standing order.
Right.
We actually got a copy of the standing order yesterday. So
okay.
So a standing order, you have to have started training that the pharmacist must have gone through in order to be able to dispense that product when the patient comes in.
Okay. And what DC hasn't really done in their legislation is define how to use the standing order. So perhaps through rulemaking, we can clarify that. Okay.
I was also under the impression that a standing order was just one of several ways to furnish naloxone. I thought that one of the other ways was just straight pharmacist prescribing. Is that not correct?
I understand it too. Yeah.
So
I think we need to take a look at those areas.
Yeah.
So the language is to the healthcare professionals, so that's both physicians and pharmacists, acting in good faith made directly or by standing order.
Okay.
Prescribed.
So it's not just a standard.
Okay. So it sounds like they could either fill according to a prescription by a doctor, or prescribe on their own, essentially furnish it, or set up an arrangement with one or more physicians via standing order, that then the terms that they would be agreed to in advance. So, great deal of flexibility there. Okay, second topic was lab oversight. So, I can talk about what we decided to do, but Carla, could you maybe remind everybody how the original legislation, what the purpose was?
This was
the clinical lab, yeah.
I don't have in front of me the different laboratory types, but basically under this legislation, all laboratory, like phlebotomists, anyone working in that capacity will need to be either licensed or registered by this board. And it's just to give them oversight and regulatory review and standards and requirements that other health professionals have. And I know that this is legislation that the Department of Health has been trying to get put in place for many, many years. So it's been determined that there was a need for it, and just like with all health professionals, to make sure that the people who are providing those services are properly trained, qualified, and doing so in a professional, ethical manner.
Thanks. So... as Carlos said, the Board of Pharmacy will be overseeing the licensing of these individuals. And so what we're waiting for, and this has been since February 2015, is an advisory committee of certain lab personnel to be formed, and those individuals would sort of guide and advise the Board of Pharmacy on some of the aspects of this as we're licensing these individuals. And so I think our to-do in terms of follow-up, Shauna, was you were going to be checking with MOTA, which I believe is the Mayor's Office of Talent Agency or something close
to
that.
Talent and Acquisition.
Talent and Acquisition, to sort of find out where they are on that.
Sure. So I did get some correspondence back from MOTA, and basically MOTA informed me that the Department of Health would now be responsible for appointing those individuals to the advisory committee.
Okay. Okay. And there is an application those individuals can fill out to be considered for the committee?
Yeah, and I would still have to go through MOTA to get that to get the applications. So they would submit the information through the MOTA website if they're interested, and then MOTA will send that information over to me.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, so that's where we are, and if, you know, the committee talked about ways we could possibly move this forward a little bit quicker if we want to, so we'll just, I guess, sort of sit for now and see where this goes, and if we feel we need to send some sort of formal communication that we're ready to roll, we can certainly do that.
Yeah, definitely. I just want to go through the information that they sent over to us. The advisory committee has to have individuals with particular experience, so I wanted to match up what is in the language in the law versus the resumes that we already have to make sure all those individual experiences are covered.
Okay. Any other questions? So then third, the drug detailers. So as you know, the Board of Pharmacy in the District of Columbia oversees registration of pharmaceutical detailers, and the original legislation was amended last year, and so there was a change made around the number of days that one would need to be working in the district, and that would determine if they needed to or not needed to get licensed. And so to that end, we're going to change the FAQ on the Board of Pharmacy site to update that and align the language with the most recent amended legislation. And the committee talked about some possibilities or opportunities to dig a little bit deeper in terms of what we think this will mean and our ability to oversee those individuals. So I think, you know, we're going to continue to have some conversation about that, understanding from the Department of Health's perspective what the impact would be if the board were to pursue changing the legislation further one way or another. And so I think that's where we'll leave it at this point. So more to come as we continue that conversation. Any questions? Okay. Then fourth, the regulatory review process. So the committee has recommended to the board that we start a regulatory review of the pharmacy regulations that the board has oversight for. So I'm speaking about Chapter 65, which is related to pharmacists, Chapter 99, which is related to technicians, and Chapter 83, which is related to the detailers. And the Pharmaceutical Control Division oversees Chapters 19 and 13, which are related to pharmacies. And so the Pharmaceutical Control Division, when they're working on regulatory changes, the committee has asked and Shauna has agreed to bring the draft language or just to make the committee aware of any regulatory changes that are being considered so that the committee or potentially the full board could just weigh in on those topics. But in the meantime, or while that's occurring, the Board of Pharmacy Committee is going to start just doing a regulatory review of all of our regs just to make sure they're up to date and aligned. And so what we're going to do is start with Chapter 65. We'll just start with A and work our way to Z, or actually they're numbered, they're not lettered. But in the meantime, there are some committee members that may have particular areas of interest that they would like to see move to the top of the agenda. So any committee member is welcome to bring that to the committee, and we can start focusing on those first. So the way that this will work is the committee will work through the regulatory changes. They'll come then to the next full open board meeting. They'll make recommendations to the full board on what they think the regulatory changes should be. And then once the board approves those regulatory changes, they will be published in the register for a public comment, and then, you know, go through the typical rulemaking process. So everybody will have an opportunity to weigh in the community. Okay, any questions about that? Okay, so just to close with what I opened with naloxone, just want to be clear that, let me ask, is anybody in the community furnishing naloxone or providing naloxone without having received a prescription from a physician? I know, that's why I'm asking.
Let's not ask them to say that they are. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So let me put it this way then. let me just put it this way. It is not legal to furnish naloxone to an individual unless you receive a prescription from a physician. Now, there is the Good Samaritan law in D.C., which allows under urgent circumstances, for example, if you have a patient in the waiting room who, you know, may be passing out because of an overdose, or you suspect an overdose, and you need to urgently administer to potentially save their life, then you are protected. But that law is not in place to routinely dispense without a prescription naloxone. So that's the law in the District of Columbia. Are there any questions?
Until
they do the training, but that is not yet in place. So are there any questions?
Yes, I have a question about the training piece that you discussed earlier. So many of the organizations already have ACPE-approved naloxone training that they've rolled out nationwide, other nationwide companies. So just a question as to whether or not the board would consider approving those CEs as group training. You obviously have the opportunity to review the training and allow those companies who use this nationally to do that. And this would allow consistency for those locations.
I think that's what we're going to look at as possible.
So let me look at one thing in the regulation. It says training completes training conducted by the Department of Health. So that, it sounds to me like that doesn't give us the latitude to
not actually conduct the training. We're probably going to come up with a program that stands and say this is what.
And so could the standards be that we would also approve other training programs out there, and the committee could do that, as well as the one we developed? Okay. Okay, so looking at the regulations or the law itself, and it says that in order to do what you're suggesting under those circumstances, that one must complete training conducted by the Department of Health. So what we're anticipating is that this work group would get together, develop a training program that could be a centralized one that anybody in the District of Columbia could take, but the work group could also talk about potentially approving other ACPE programs that are out there for naloxone training. But that is not currently in place.
Yeah, and I guess the question is maybe we could allow those, almost as a proxy, to allow the organizations to conduct the training. It's been approved by the Department of Health. Just a consideration.
Yeah, so nothing's been approved yet.
Correct.
So I would just say at this point, it's not legal, but...
Understood.
Okay.
Question.
Yes, ma'am.
If that is indeed the case that you would consider using the national training, would it then be retroactive for all of the pharmacists that have taken that training and maybe using it in the District of Columbia?
So there's not a nationally approved training program, but there are, so organizations may have developed their own ACPE approved training for naloxone, and then organizations that are very large in scope like national may have one that they tap into across jurisdictions, and as long as it's ACPE approved, it's fine. Whether one could, yeah, I don't know whether one could actually go back and retroactively apply that, because it could be like any CE course that's, you know, could you apply retroactively? I don't know that we're in a position to answer that yet. I think that's part of the conversation.
Okay. All things will
okay. Yeah, okay. Okay. So that is our committee report, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Very extensive report. Just for the sake of, I guess, maybe some of the public members, public individuals in the audience, there are a lot of questions about the naloxone. And out of curiosity, at the NAVP meeting, it came up about the Good Samaritan Act, and something came up that I wasn't familiar with. I'm familiar with what you just stated in terms of if there's something going on in an emergency, then as pharmacists, we are able to act accordingly. But at the NAVP meeting, it was mentioned that if there's an individual who comes into the pharmacy and they have a friend or whoever is, you know, overdosing and they need to come and get naloxone, the Good Samaritan law actually covers that individual from being arrested or anything if they have any drugs on them. Have you heard of that before? Is that something that DC, we don't have that under our Good Samaritan law? Do you follow what I'm saying?
They have illegal drugs under them?
Yeah, but under this Good Samaritan law, I forgot what state it was that made the comment. That person who's helping their friend out, they are not able to get like arrested or anything because of their drugs.
So you're not suggesting that the Good Samaritan law allows them to just furnish naloxone. You're saying that if they have drugs on them, that...
No, let me just rephrase it. And I hope this is a practical question. So in terms of naloxone, so you have a friend who's out in the parking lot who looks like they're overdosing. You run into the pharmacy. Let's say by now that, you know, we have, you know, the standing order and all that kind of stuff. You run into the pharmacy, hey, my friend is ODing, I need to get naloxone or whatever. But you actually have drugs on you. So apparently under the Good Samaritan law, you cannot be arrested or anything because you're trying to help your friend who's overdosing. So I guess my question is, does our Good Samaritan law cover individuals who are trying to help someone else who's overdosing? Does it protect them from being arrested with illegal drugs?
I'd have to review it, and I think it's more so like if the police show up on the scene,
right,
and while they're going through everything, somehow it's discovered in your pocket, you are carrying, there's probably some limitations for you, because otherwise you're gonna let them die and not report because you don't wanna get arrested. And the whole point is we're trying to save their life, and that's more important than whether or not somebody gets arrested because they have something in their pocket that they shouldn't. So I can't say for sure without looking at it, but my guess is that there's probably something in there for that purpose.
Yeah, I thought that was, I've never thought about it, it's more in that regard, but I guess that would be helpful to know.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Right.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Very good. Thank you. Any questions from the public before we move on? I know Alan covered a lot of information there. No? All right. So next item on the agenda is the communications subcommittee report. And so since I'm here, the only member of the communications subcommittee here today, I'm pleased to report that we did submit our content for the June newsletter. And so that should be coming out, I guess, in a couple of weeks or so. I'd like to just remind the audience as well as our board and staff members that we need content. If there are things that you would like to see us cover in the newsletter, please by all means let that be known so that we can get that information and get it in advance so that we're not putting our wonderful executive director under the gun to try to get it approved at the last minute. But we will have a June edition that is going to be coming out, so be on the lookout for that.
Yes.
What types of contributions are you looking for the newsletter?
So, I mean, not necessarily contributions from the public, but if there are topics that you'd like to see covered. For example, in this upcoming edition, we did another review about pharmacy robberies. That's a hot topic that's now back on the radar across the country. I wouldn't be surprised if there's some content in the NABP section on that as well, at least some of it. So topics that you are interested in hearing more about. Maybe our pharmacists are interested in some out-of-the-box pharmacy practice areas here in D.C. For example, one of the notes that I took at the NABP meeting is, I think it would be interesting for our readers to hear from maybe a pharmacist who's practicing in a correctional facility. That's not something that we hear about a whole lot. You know, how is their practice focus a little bit different than what we typically see maybe in a hospital or community pharmacy or whatnot? Maybe some information about what new regulations or new areas NABP is focused on as a whole that will impact not only the District of Columbia, but all other states. So topics, if there are topics that you're interested in hearing, then just let us know that. Yes.
So I'll mention a topic for future consideration.
Okay.
I don't know if it's appropriate, it's a good fit or not, but you know, there's a lot of focus on opioid use and abuse, and there was a conference, and Shauna attended, right, maybe 2-3 weeks ago in Maryland, and it was attended by the mayor, the governor of Virginia, and the governor of Maryland. All three spoke. There were, I think, 4 sponsor organizations. It was all day, and there were lots of speakers and breakout sessions. And so, you know, obviously there's a great deal of interest on behalf of the District of Columbia and residents as well about opioid use and abuse and substance abuse in general. So, you know, there might be an avenue there, the department, because it's related to pharmaceuticals, perhaps it's something we might want to explore.
You know, I was even wondering, I don't know how possible it is, but I remember when these conversations first started taking place about, like, opioid abuse, and I wonder what does the landscape in D.C. look like in terms of what are we facing? Is this something that's just really limited to, you know, some rural area somewhere? But if we can kind of get some kind of idea of what that abuse profile, what cases we have been experiencing here in D.C. and maybe how it compares to our neighbors in Virginia and Maryland, I think maybe our audience that would be helpful, I think. So maybe if we can try to get some, you know, a better perspective in terms of what that looks like in D.C., but that would mean we would have to, I guess, work with, like, our investigation team.
No, that would not. We work with an investigation unit because they wouldn't necessarily have that information.
Okay.
So that would be something that you have to obtain from someplace like Fire and EMS.
Oh, okay.
Chief Medical Examiner's Office, because those are the agencies that's going to have that information.
Good idea. I didn't even think about that. Perfect. And I'm sure in D.C., the fire and EMS drivers, they all carry naloxone and things like that, right?
Yes,
I know in Maryland, they do. Okay.
Right,
yes.
And then also, I'm not sure which, I know certain information is public, but we just have to find out what information is public and that we can publish.
So
not exactly sure, but I know we could probably get some information, but I'm not exactly sure to the depth of what we can
Yeah, so for example, the mayor talked about a number of programs that are run in the district, and so for the pharmacy community to know where and what the resources are would be nice.
Definitely, yeah.
That's a great idea, too. Okay, good, very good. All right. Next item on our agenda is our DOH pharmacy intern presentation, so we're going to have our 2 interns come up and give us an overview of what's going on as it relates to pharmacy across the country.
Good morning, everyone. Once again, I'm going to reintroduce myself. I'm Ashby Johnson. I'm a 4th-year doctor of pharmacy candidate at the illustrious Howard University. And my colleague.
My name is Billy Internation. I'm also a 4th-year doctor of pharmacy candidate at Howard University.
Okay, and today what we're going to do is we're going to discuss a couple of articles from the NABP newsletter that we feel is our major concern and maybe brought to your attention. The first article I want to discuss with you is the FDA has issued contraindication labels for both tramadol and codeine. The first one is going to be for children under 12 years old. Normally, tramadol is not prescribed for individuals under 18, but it has been stated that in off-label uses, tramadol has been prescribed. It's now being contraindicated for that particular reason. In addition to that, there's also going to be a contraindication labeled for children under the age of 18 who've just been treated with tonsillitis or adenoid. The reason being, since they just had this particular surgery, their breathing problems may persist at that time, and being treated with these particular medications may pretty much have respiratory depression that may occur, so we want to kind of avoid that. The reason that this is actually taking place is because with the codeine, it's an ultra-rapid metabolizer that's actually affecting, so you're going to have pretty much fatal levels of morphine that's going to be introduced, and so that's going to affect the patient. So we actually want to be made aware that this is out now and that we want to take heed of these particular recommendations. Next article, a part of this one, is also the FDA's issued warnings for both tramadol and codeine for individuals between the ages of 12 and 18. And once again, this is for individuals who are obese, they have severe lung disease and sleep apnea, and also it's going to have the same mechanism of action where the respiratory system is actually going to be somewhat depressed. It's also going to be masked because, of course, with that you're going to have a buildup of CO2. And so you may not actually really see it, but basically it's going to have a problem with the CNS later, and then you're going to go through that particular overdose. And you definitely want to avoid it. So that's going to be issued as a warning. And also for mothers who are breastfeeding, is now being recommended as a warning to not actually take these particular medications because it has been having negative effects on the infant. They're going to perceive actually excess sleepiness in the infants and also going to have breathing problems going forward. The next article I would like to bring to your attention is the FDA has now issued a black box warning for the drug Invokana. This is used to treat type 2 diabetes. It's been revealed from the CANVAS study. The study's primary outcome was actually to try to find out any cardiovascular effects with the particular drug. And what they found out is comparing placebo and also comparing Invokana, 5 out of 9 of 1,000 patients had amputations compared to 2.8 out of those individuals who received the placebo medications. What you want to actually take heed of, maybe for prescribers, if, for example, if the individual has had a previous amputation, if they have any type of sores, any type of neuropathy, this may not actually want to be the medication that you want to actually prescribe to that particular patient. There are a lot of diabetic medications that are out there that maybe provide better effectiveness for this particular patient without the concern that they may have to have an amputation going forward. And basically, at this particular time, in the wake of the opioid epidemics around the world in the country, this new street drug has just been introduced called Gray Death. It's a pretty horrific drug because of the ingredients that's actually included in it. It has fentanyl. It also has carfentanil. And if you're not familiar with carfentanil, it's actually going to be used as a tranquilizer for large animals. It's not actually used for human use because it's so powerful. And it also has the synthetic opioid U47700 with the street name of Pink. Some of you individuals may be familiar with this particular drug. Recently, it was declassified as a controlled substance one because of the wake of the multiple fatalities that occurred in both New York and North Carolina. And this is also one of the ingredients, and of course, heroin. The interesting thing about this drug, which makes it so much so traumatic and so, you know, horrific, is that it's only $30 a gram, so it's pretty much very inexpensive, and it's going to have all these ingredients included in one. And this is pretty much how the drug actually will look when it's on the street. And the way it actually can be used is it's stated that it can be ingested, of course, it can be snorted, and it can be smoked, and it also can be used for IV. So this is something that you definitely would want to take heed of. And now we have Ms. Galeen, and she'll continue the presentation.
So an article that I found interesting was that there was a new bill introduced to Congress in January of 2017 titled the Safe and Affordable Drugs from Canada Act. The act would essentially amend the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act to allow patients to import medications from Canada. The goals that the senator had for this bill was to bring down drug costs, have savings for consumers, introduce a greater competition to the pharmaceutical market, and they essentially thought that because Canadians pay about half of what we pay for their prescription medications, it would be fair that our U.S. consumers have that opportunity as well. The only way you can import medications from Canada is through having a valid U.S. prescription filled at a certified Canadian pharmacy that is certified by the Homeland Security Department. And the prescription can only be for personal use for a maximum 90-day supply, and has to have the same active drug route of administration, dosage form, and strength as the medication that you would fill here in the United States. Also, you cannot import any controlled medications or any biologics and medications that have to be refrigerated. Although essentially the bill is a good idea, there was a lot of opposition from U.S. agencies and also their Canadian counterparts. The NAEP Executive Director, Carmen Catazon, issued a statement saying that illegal internet pharmacies can simply put a maple leaf logo on a counterfeit medication bought from other countries and sell them to U.S. patients when they couldn't even sell them legally in Canada. Likewise, the College of Pharmacists of Manitoba issued a statement saying that it was reckless to send U.S. consumers to buy medications online from Canada, thinking that they would get unapproved, substandard, and counterfeit medications from unknown sources, and it would be a threat to public safety. The next article, which is related to the issue of online counterfeit medications, is more of a national issue. The Alliance for Safe Online Pharmacies recently started a campaign to educate healthcare providers and pharmacists, physicians against the harmful effects of buying online medications online, and they could be counterfeit or even illegal medications being sold under false names just to make a profit. They had a CE course titled Internet Drug Sellers, where they essentially taught the providers about the harmful effects of buying medications online, and they discovered that less than 10% were aware that counterfeit medications were being sold online, and only 1.4% actually discussed it with their patients, the harmful effects of buying medications online. So they created this website titled buysaferx.pharmacy. They have endless resources for both consumers, healthcare providers, policymakers, and even the media to help raise awareness of the issue. They have anything from fact sheets about the toxins found in online medications, the number of patient harm, and they have infographics, podcasts, blogs, and lots of other tools to educate the public and make them aware of the issue. The last article was about vaccine abbreviations and how they are leading to unnecessary errors. So usually vaccines, when they're prescribed, they're used to the 2 or 4 letter abbreviations that they have. Because the letters are so similar and the order is changed in some of them, it has come to the attention that wrong vaccines have been given to the wrong patients. For example, the MMR and the MMRV. The MMR is the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine. The V has the varicella, which is only for pediatric patients. It has been noticed that the MMRV is being prescribed or being administered to adult patients, which can cause them to have an adverse reaction, as the titer for the varicella is too high. They don't need that vaccine. It's only for children. And likewise, the MMR was being given to pediatric patients where they're not being given the varicella vaccine, which they need, and they're not having any coverage. So it's very important that pharmacists pay extra attention when they're describing. The ISMP, Institute for Safe Medication Practices, is urging a ban on using these abbreviated names, and has provided a guidance for pharmacists to try to write out the full name whenever they can when they're dispensing the medication, double and triple checking the prescription and what is being dispensed to make sure that it's the right thing because of the one letter differences, and also verify with the patient and confirm that they know what they're getting and you're dispensing what they know that they should be receiving. Thank you.
Question was, yes. This is a recommendation that they do away with the acronyms and abbreviations?
Yes, the ISMP is urging legislation to ban the acronyms and just use the full name.
So would legislation be at for each state, or would it be federal legislation?
I'm not quite sure about that one.
Okay.
They're just urging lawmakers to take into consideration.
Interesting. Great report, both of you. Thank you very much.
Any questions from the public before you guys take a seat? Questions, comments? Yes. If you don't mind, could you just state your name?
Carolyn Price, president of the Washington, D.C. Pharmacy Association.
Okay.
In a previous life, I was the director of the D.C. warehouse, pharmacy warehouse. And we were commissioned about 12 years ago. There was a recommendation that the warehouse look into possibly getting drugs from Canada. So we have gone through this. We did a full report, and it was basically, essentially the same thing came out, that the drugs were not really reliable. So we have gone through this before, about 10 or 12 years ago. So I guess now the emphasis may be to try to look into getting medications from Canada again. But when we did a study, we did an extensive study and got a lot of information about importing drugs into the District of Columbia from Canada. And essentially, we found that that was not a good idea, basically for the same reasons that you discussed in your presentation. So I think it's good that information is coming around again.
Okay, good.
That's
good feedback. Any other comments? Yes.
Quick question. So where is the bill at right now? Is it in being debated right now in the Senate, in the House? Where is it at?
It was just introduced in Congress, and no further action has been taken on it as of yet.
There's a lot of interest in it, so I mean, if you Google, you'll see there's a lot of pushback. I would be very surprised if it passes. Very surprised. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Great presentation. So there are just a couple of things that I want to add on to, and the next item on the agenda, you'll see the NABPE newsletter. There are a couple of things that I think, as an audience, we want to make sure that we just mention here. So let me just do another quick review. So in the NABPE news that edition, and you can find the NABPE newsletters on their website, NABP.pharmacy. They're in the .pharmacy domain now. One of the first things that they mentioned is the safety of U.S. drug supply chain that's threatened by this recent congressional importation proposal. So basically, in January, as it was noted, there was a move to kind of allow U.S. citizens to get drugs from Canada. And as you probably would understand, I hope you can read between the lines, there are several different groups that are strongly opposed to this. You know, there are two ways to look at this, and I won't get on a soapbox because it's probably not the right thing to do. But when you look at the heart of what's driving this, it's the high drug costs here in the United States. And that's something that nobody wants to talk about. If you are in Canada and you go to one of their pharmacies or whatever, more than likely you really will get the same medicine for half or a third of the price. That's the honest truth. So what if people decided, if you're strapped for money, you want to get something at a lower price, you're going to try to do that. However, individuals that really do not have your best interest at heart have capitalized on that, and this is what they'll do. I think in the presentation it was mentioned when Carmen said, you have people in, when they looked at this, a lot of the actual sources of the drugs that people were ordering, they were not coming from Canada. They were coming from China, they were coming from India, Mexico, all these other places. So you technically can stick a maple leaf on it, and you're thinking you're getting a good, solid product from Canada. And that's not necessarily happening. And so we continue to make sure the public understands the dangers of ordering drugs online. That's just a danger, because at the end of the day, you really don't know where it's coming from. But I really look forward to when we have that other conversation. And that other conversation in terms of how do we lower drug costs here in the United States so that individuals won't have to do that. And so that's just my little spiel. But so again, this is just a lot of mention of how several organizations are opposed to it. And they're saying they're opposed to it because of the dangers. And I will give them the benefit of the doubt and say that is the honest to goodness reason why they're mostly opposed to it. However, you know, at the end of the day, this is some of it is about cost. In April, the DEA held a huge drug take back, and they had 5,000 collection sites set up across the country and collected over 900,000 pounds of unneeded medication. Why is that important to what we've been talking about today and what's all on the news? Keep in mind, a lot of times people get their hands on opioids from the medicine cabinet in their house or from their auntie's house, or they go over to their friend's house and they go in the cabinet and get dad's old Percocet that he's had in there for 2 months, never took all up. My point is, I think one message that we're trying to send loud and clear as pharmacists is get unused opioids, medication period, out of your medicine cabinet. Get it out of your medicine cabinet before it ends up in the wrong hands. And so these drug take-backs, they may seem like they're just a good idea, but they really are pertinent to the conversation that we're having with abuse. I remember our good friend Herb Quash, who mentioned a couple of years ago what our young people are doing. And when I say young people, I'm talking about young people in middle school and high school. They have parties and they do something called farming. So they'll have all these different pills. Half of the time, these kids, they don't know what they're taking. They just know, oh, it's a prescription pill. Maybe I can get high. And they just grab stuff and just take it, believe it or not. As crazy as it sounds, you can Google it. But the point is, please support the DEA drug take-back days. If there's not an official drug take-back day, a lot of the police stations in D.C., they have things set up where you can come and dispose of your unused prescription drugs, but you won't want to call first before you go there. But the point is, get unused medications out of your medicine cabinet, because they can end up in the wrong hands.
I want us to also shift our thinking in a little bit. Can you imagine how someone is feeling if they take a drug called Gray Death? Like, how badly are they feeling about themselves, and what type of underlying mental health issues are they dealing with while they want to take a
is carfentanyl, fentanyl?
Yeah, the
heroin and the
tranquilizer, an animal tranquilizer. So I think that we really need to, as pharmacists, especially because we interact with people all day, every day, really try to understand why are people wanting to abuse drugs like this. So it's more than a conversation of if you see somebody coming to get an early refill or trying to pay cash for their Percocet. I really feel like we have a responsibility to dig a little bit deeper and really try to figure out what's going on with that person. We need to be comfortable with that.
Not to belabor the point, but it was interesting in talking to one of the doctors in Northeast, who his whole practice is treating addicts, recovering addicts in D.C., and it was eye-opening to me to learn that there are a lot of people in this country who turn to street drugs, like heroin, especially heroin, because they can't get their prescription pain pills. Now, whether they should be taking them or they're abusing those pain pills or not, the point is what these individuals are saying is, when I get a runaround from the pharmacist or my doctor won't give me a prescription, I shoot up. And I never put those two things together. And so it really is a deeper conversation that we need to have as it relates to drug abuse and opioid abuse. For the pharmacists in the audience and the technicians, Truxan is a pharmacy company that have expanded the recall in April 2017. They did a label mix-up, and so some of the bottles that really were, if I can remember this, amitriptyline, it was a mix-up between amitriptyline and there's another one. I'll get to it in 1 second because I can't remember, but it was a mislabel mix-up of two different drugs, and they were packaged by Truxan. So just be on the lookout for that. Oh, phenobarbital. The good thing is these weren't sent to pharmacies. They were sent to doctor's offices. So, hopefully it won't be as widespread as it would have been if they actually sent them out to pharmacies or whatnot. Let's see. something else that people was really interested in. I thought this was interesting. So in Omaha, the pharmacists out in the community, they're doing something a little unique to try to connect with consumers about the dangers of controlled substances. So they created like this warning sticker. I know we have enough stickers that we stick on bottles already. But they created like this warning sticker that they're sticking on the top, on the cap of their prescription opioids, so that consumers are aware of the dangers of taking too much or taking too little. Believe it or not, there are some people, they will treat these pain pills like Tylenol. They just feel like, well, I know it says to take two, but I've hurt real bad. I'm going to take four of these. But that could be a bad thing. So we want to make sure that people are aware of that. And I think the other thing that I'll just mention, just yesterday it was in the news, there was a pilot who flew for, some of you might have seen this, raise your hand if you saw this, it was in Ohio, a Spirit Airline pilot and his wife out in the wonderful suburbs of Ohio were found dead in the house by their two children. They were doing cocaine, but the thing that a lot of people are now, dealers are doing now, to increase the high of the cocaine, they're mixing in other stuff with it. So in this situation, it was mixed with carfentanil. Carfentanil, as was mentioned by Ashby, that is used to tranquilize elephants,
horses,
and rhinos, horses.
Much.
It is, they say it's what, 10,000 times stronger than morphine. Here's the point. Nobody is safe in this. If you are a poor guy living on the street, a homeless guy who wants to get high, you're going to shoot up. You don't know what's mixed in with that heroin. Or if you're a nice airline pilot and you and your wife want to have a little fun one evening and you want to snort some coke, you don't even know what that stuff is mixed with now. The reason the dealers are mixing the stuff with fentanyl and carfentanil and all of that stuff is because in the streets, the higher you can get, the better. And this dealer wants his product to get you higher than that dealer. The bad thing is, people are trying to get high in a controlled manner, some of them, and they don't know what they're taking and they're dying. And this is a serious thing. You know, and it's not even a judgmental thing, but I think as pharmacists, we really need to be aware of what's going on. It's not just, you know, your cocaine or whatever. These people have gotten smart, and they know how to get some of these synthetic products. And you, if you know anybody who might be using, just remind them, you really don't know what's in that bag of white powder. You really don't know what's in that. It looks like concrete. That's what that gray death looked like. They said it looks like a little chip, a block of concrete. You don't know what's mixed in with that. So I guess my point is, pharmacists, we're healthcare providers. We have a real big problem going on in this country with drug abuse and death. So I just wanted to note that. That's all I wanted to add.
On that happy note.
So, I think the last thing I just wanted to share with you, we had a really good time a couple of weeks ago in Orlando at the 113th meeting of the National Association of Boards of Pharmacy. The District of Columbia was well represented. I attended, Dr. White attended, Mr. Bellegard attended. It was his first time attending as a consumer member. Some of you probably haven't met Mr. Bellegard. And I think I will speak for him, and I'll say one of the biggest things he enjoyed was the food. There was a lot of food. There's a lot of good food. I do want to share with you some key things. Remember, NABP regulates all boards of pharmacy across the country. So there were 10 resolutions that were considered, and I just want to highlight a few of them because they may impact what we do someday in the District of Columbia as well as in Maryland and Virginia. So there's a Model State Pharmacy Act and Model Rules of the National Association of Boards of Pharmacy. That act kind of says how pharmacy is practiced overall, and there's several different sections. Based on the resolutions that we voted on at the meeting a couple of weeks ago, there are a couple of things that they're looking at changing in that practice act. One of them is as it relates to involving pharmacy technicians on boards of pharmacy, and that's actually one of them that did not pass. Another one is defining the patient-pharmacist relationship. Remember we talked about the doctor-pharmacist relationship, where they're going to take a look at the Practice Act and see about maybe do we need to redefine a pharmacist-patient relationship. Another area of the Practice Pharmacy Act that they're taking a look at is they're putting a task force together to take a look at long-term care pharmacy. Because as we know, the population, the aging population is growing. And so in terms of how we take care of individuals in long-term care, they thought it would be a good idea to put a task force together to take a look at that. Another task force is being commissioned to take a look at developing regulations for compounding of animal products. So as we know, as pharmacists, especially in DC and other places, in some states you're more involved with compounding animal products than others, but basically NABP is gonna put a task force together to take a look at, do we need to put some regulations in place about compounding of animal products. Another resolution that passed, and this was kind of interesting. So NABP is convening stakeholders to kind of look at how they can put something formal together to allow students and practitioners who are in other countries to come over to the United States and get clinical training. And so that resolution actually passed. And so I think some of you who are affiliated with pharmacy schools or in your pharmacy, you might be a site where a training site. Maybe there's some of you who are already involved in some of the training of students and practitioners from other countries, but it's becoming something that's so big that NABP has actually taken a hard look at making that somewhat more uniform of how students as well as practicing pharmacists abroad, they can come over here and get some training experience. I think there are two more things. Okay, those didn't pass. Oh, the other thing in terms of the Pharmacy Act, NABP is going to put a group together to take a look at establishing consistency of packaging unit of use containers. And so for those institutions that are involved in unit dosing, I think that might be something that's important. There's a lot of conversation about pharmacy technicians. As you know, the District of Columbia doesn't have a pharmacy to farm tech ratio. Some states do. There was a lot of discussion about that and maybe whether that's a good thing and maybe some of the concerns that's caused around it. There was a lot of discussion about expanding the role of the pharmacist. I had a real good conversation with some students yesterday evening. We've talked about pharmacists getting certification, they're board certified, we can give immunizations, we're fighting for provider status. We have automation, we have technology in the pharmacies to kind of do some of the manual things that pharmacists used to do. We have technicians that are now being regulated. They are trained and they have a license and whatnot. At some point, I think we're gonna have to put a little bit more of the focus on what the ideal pharmacy practice that some of us have in mind, what that really looks like. In other words, you know, you can have technicians available to assist. You can have well-trained pharmacists who can provide these outstanding clinical services. But until the pharmacy or the clinic or wherever is going to reimburse the pharmacist for some of the services that they're providing, I'm afraid that we're kind of like dancing in circles. And so I think the ground is laid. We have the individuals in the right places to do the things that need to be done, but at some point we're going to have to really start to become more realistic and accept the fact that we've got to talk about a different way of pharmacists and pharmacies being reimbursed for some of these services if this really is going to take place. So there was a lot of conversation around some of those things. I don't know if there's anything else I'm leaving out. Anything else that kind of stood out with you?
No, I think you covered it.
That's my executive director's way of telling me that it's time to wrap it up.
No, she did cover everything. Did you have any questions?
I have one question. Well, first of all, thank you all, or the three members of the board and staff that went. It's great that we were so well represented, and I did hear from other folks outside of this group that went and said it was a really good meeting. I'm just curious, has there been any further conversation on planning efforts for our hosting a district meeting in, was it 2018?
Absolutely. So I was actually going to give you an overview of that. So we had another conference call on Tuesday? I think it was Tuesday. And so this is where we are. And again, we are still ahead of the game, but in talking to the hotels, we're, this is a good time for us to start securing locations. For those of you who might not know, there's a rotation of District 1 and 2 meetings. And so this year, in September, the meeting will be in Connecticut. Well, guess what? In 2018, the meeting will be right here in D.C. And so we're starting the planning. We've started the planning around that. Right now, we're looking at a venue. The main place that it looks like we will probably be using, again, this isn't confirmed because I want to make sure to bring this through the proper channels before we confirm this. The Hyatt Regency on Capitol Hill is very close to Union Station. There are a block of dates that they're working with us on, and that's one thing that I do want to get, one of several things that I want to get some feedback from our board members on. Typically, our district meetings are Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and so that's the preferred time slot. I gave them September 13th, 14th, and 15th, but I also told them that we can be flexible. We can do September 20th, 21st, and 22nd. And we can do September 27th, 28th, 29th. Here's why it's a good idea to have options. Because I was informed that depending on which week we use, we may save about $20 in the room charge. So right now, the quote that they have given for September 13th, 14th, and 15th is $179 per night, which is $20 more than what we'll be paying in Connecticut. We're paying $159 per night at that meeting. However, this is D.C. compared to Connecticut, so you know, I guess we can anticipate the cost might be a bit different. We will be putting together, I don't know if we're going to approach this as a task force, because what I've been thinking may be a good thing to, for us to do is we'll look at the two overall tasks and just get volunteers of who's going to help with what. There are two main things that we have to work on, other than the venue part. One is fundraising. Typically, the target is to raise $30,000 for this meeting. However, in D.C., I want us to try to raise a little bit more, maybe about $40,000, $50,000, if at all possible. We have a block of donors that donate to this every single year. CVS, Walgreens, and different, you know, places I have on a list. But we've got to start to seriously fundraise for the event. And then the second super, super important part is the programming. And so we will be offering CEs. We will also be hosting a reception. There are about four places that have been recommended for the reception, everywhere from the National Art Museum, Charlie Palmer Steak, which I heard is fabulous. The hotel highly recommends that place. There's a place called 40 something. It's a rooftop, 40 and something, I'm getting it wrong. It has a really nice rooftop view that's near Union Station. And then there is a really nice, there's a meal room at the Hyatt that also has a panoramic view for reception as well. And so my point is, fundraising is gonna be a big thing, and then the program is gonna be a big thing. The color guard, we got lots of high schools in DC that we can get their color guard. The entertainment, we got lots of entertainment that can play at our reception. The keynote speaker, this year's keynote speaker was the guy from the Huffington Post. Tell me his name. Drawing a blank. It's the guy from the Huffington, Howard Fineman.
Oh yeah.
Howard Fineman was the keynote speaker this year.
He's good.
At the national meeting.
But for our district meeting, what I was thinking, we gotta have some kind of, I don't want to say politics, but something with like a couple of Congress people, I think, come through. We're in D.C., so I feel like with people coming to D.C., maybe it's something we can consider. Again, this is a group effort, but maybe it's something to consider with us having, like, you know, Buddy Carter is the only pharmacist who's a member of Congress that's here. He was at Howard in April. His good friend is the representative from Georgia. We can certainly get him if we want him, but we need to just think about the programming part. So fundraising, I'm gonna say $50,000 target, as well as the programming. Those are the main things that we'll need to work on. I talked to the Hyatt as recently as yesterday. And so they're just trying to nail down which of these time frames we can save the most on the registration cost. The other thing, I talked to Carolyn about this as well in terms of attendance. Typically, the registration numbers have been as low as 90 to as high as about 129. Keep in mind, there's some people who live here, they're not going to be staying in the hotel. So the hotel block, at first I requested 200 rooms, but I think maybe we should scale that back a little bit. And so I asked them instead to let's try to get 125 rooms blocked. However, that's still open for consideration. They sent a draft proposal, but they're revising that. And so as soon as that comes through, then we'll kind of have a deeper conversation about it. But we've got to start looking at what the hotel block, the rooms are going to look like.
Thank you. Well, clearly a lot of work going into this. I'm wondering if, so I agree Union Station is probably a good location for people traveling. The other hotel to consider, just in terms of that they typically host meetings, is the Marriott next to the Convention Center. I don't know if you looked at that or not.
The one that I called was the Marriott that's, you guys know, the new Marriott that's by that Five Guys that Obama used to go to.
I don't know where
that is. Yeah, I think that's New York Avenue. Yeah, so I checked that.
Marriott Marquis is by the Convention Center, but we're going to be priced out of that. That's going to be.
Yeah, I have no idea.
I didn't check at the one at the Convention Center. I checked at the other one, but they don't have a meeting room that can hold more than 130 people.
So the Marriott Marquis, I guess, is it's huge. I mean, it's a beautiful facility, and it is near Metro. And I would imagine because it's near the Convention Center that they do have space for big meetings, but I have no idea what the price structure is. But just in terms of competitive pricing, and especially if they know you're looking at other venues, and likewise, if the Hyatt knows you're looking at other venues, you know, that might serve a good purpose as well. But it sounds like you've got good pricing over there.
Yeah, so far things are coming right along. One of the main things, though, I want us to have a really good program. We need to have a solid program. Everybody's doing the CEs on opioid abuse and naloxone and all that. In 2018, I know it's going to be difficult for us to think a year ahead, but we need to start thinking about what our program is going to look like. And we need a phenomenal keynote speaker. So, again, I think what I'll do is I'll just do like a table with the areas of things that we want, and in fairness, let people volunteer. And when you don't volunteer, we'll just kind of assign you to do something. But think about the fundraising part. Like I said, typically the places like CVS, Walgreens, and all, they'll donate like $5,000 or $2,500. Well, that's a far cry from like $50,000. So we got some work to do, but I think we're in a good location. I think we have great relationships, and I think we'll be able to pull this off.
Well, I know it's a lot of work, and having attended some other districts and talked to the people who plan those, there's definitely a lot that goes into it. And I'm sure that board members would be happy to help. And having a structure that we can kind of all look at and see where we can kind of support the effort. I'm happy to do that. We don't want it to fall just on you and Shauna, right? So let us know how we can help and how we can be part of the conversations.
And Tijal and I have a call scheduled for tomorrow. We're talking tomorrow at 3 or 3:30, something like that. Just so that, because Tijal is the treasurer. And so it's for us to be on the same page and, to let her know that, look, these are some of the cost things that we might need to consider. Cost is an issue because that Charlie Palmer restaurant is not cheap. It's beautiful, but it's kind of pricey. So depending on where we want to put our money, we need to look at the different options.
So the other advantage of working, with the board at large also is that there may be people on the board who know of other venues or have contacts that you could consider, right?
Absolutely.
And then secondly, there may be, since the District of Columbia Board of Pharmacy is hosting, how do people feel on the board about certain things? Like, are there certain programs that the board wants in terms of the CE or in terms of that entertainment venue? Some of the meetings have been really pretty spectacular, and are there certain things we'd like to do or not like to do? So just having people weigh in where appropriate.
Right. So here's what we're going to do. Between meetings, there'll be a lot of planning. And so what we will make sure that we do is at all of the open sessions, like today, we'll update the audience on where we are. But there's a lot that we can do via email and conference calls.
Yep.
And I think it's going to be the best meeting in years.
Of course.
So
of course.
I'm excited about that.
Okay, great.
Yes, and so this is the district meetings are actually joint meetings, and I'm glad you brought that up. They're joint meetings between NABP and AACP. Okay, so for those in the audience, AACP is the body that oversees all pharmacy schools across the country. And so some of the programming, like there are two sets of round tables, some of the deans, the chair, the people from the pharmacy schools, they're going to be more interested in those topics. The individuals that are more so associated with like practicing pharmacists and boards of pharmacy, they will be interested in another topic. So we'll be offering at least two programs that are geared towards like the deans of the pharmacy schools and whatnot. So a lot of good conversation. Again, joint meeting, there'll even be remarks that are made by someone from NABP. I talked to Dana. Dana wants to make sure that Jeannie, I think is the one who's going to be speaking at ours. No, Sue Kasich. Sue Kasich is going to be the NABP president in 2018, so she's already putting it on her calendar once that time slot is confirmed. She'll be giving remarks at our meeting. AACP is right in Virginia, so I'm sure Lucinda Main is probably going to be here, maybe Pete Velasquez, Greg Boyer. So we'll have some good people here representing both, both.
APHA's here.
APHA's here, ASHP's here. I even thought about us going on the rooftop at APHA. They have beautiful receptions up there.
Yeah.
I just don't know how much they're going to charge us. So
they might give us a discount.
They might, especially with one of our board members in his previous relationship.
Right.
So some good planning. I'm just really excited. I think we're all very excited. And the meeting will only be a success if our constituents get excited about it as well. Remember, even at these meetings, you don't have to be a board member to kind of come and listen to some of the top regulations that are about to probably affect the entire country. So take advantage if you can come in, even if you can't stay for all 3 days, come for half a day or something. But hopefully you can take advantage of it.
Thanks.
Any questions? No? All right, so now the fun part. We will actually entertain comments from the public. I know we kind of ran a little over and we lost a couple of people. I'll start off. I know there are a couple of faces that came in and you didn't get a chance to kind of state your name for the record. Please make sure you do that at this time. And again, make sure everybody signs the sign-in sheet that's somewhere back there. So I'm going to start. Dr. Moore, did you?
Good morning. I'm Terry Moore. I'm representing the Washington, D.C. Pharmacy Association. And now that I'm here before, let me just say and remind people that WDCPHA is the voice and resource for pharmacists, pharmacy students, and pharmacy technicians here in the District of Columbia. We have a couple of upcoming events that we would like to make sure you're aware of. On June the 15th, we are having an educational program and networking reception. And also the first Saturday in October, we're having our annual meeting where we have all day CE programming. We do a town forum discussing some of these same relevant issues in pharmacy. Please visit our website, wdcpha.com, for more details on both of those events. And we also welcome all of you to become members of the association. That is the primary way that we can carry out our mission of being the voice and resource of pharmacy in D.C.
Thank you. Good to see you. Anyone else?
Yes, I wanted to just pass out some flyers when we were talking about the MMR and the MMRB, because I'm from immunizations, that's great, and that we know that the reason why we're here is because we know that pharmacy is leading immunizations. A lot more people, we talk about this all the time, they go to CVS, Costco, Walgreens to get their vaccination as opposed to from their primary provider. So I was just passing out the adult immunization schedule because pediatric rates are great. Everyone knows about their children and what vaccines they need. But then do we know what vaccines we need as an adult, as a booster, beyond just flu season? So that's all that I had to share. And it's an article from the Adult Immunization Summit with CDC talking about the relationship and partnerships with the physician and pharmacist, which you have spoke about.
Thank you.
That's just to support everything that you all have already discussed today.
So you have copies of those that mm-hmm. I can pass out?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Tracy.
Good morning.
I'm
Dr. Tracy Davis. I'm Director of Pharmacy for AmeriHealthcare at Hospice City. And I'm here to visit.
Good to see you. It's been years.
Hi, Tracy.
Is there anyone else that might not have had a chance to introduce yourselves?
Yeah. I came in a few minutes late. I'm Jonas Terry, pharmacist with the Department of Healthcare Finance.
Welcome.
Hi, I'm Charlene Fairfax, pharmacist also with the Department of Healthcare Finance. I just want to give a reminder to all of our DC Medicaid pharmacies to make sure that you upload your new pharmacy license into our enrollment broker's website, because all the licenses should have started over today. The old pharmacy license expired on May 31st, 2017. So the new license should be available today. And we need to have a copy of that that's uploaded to the profile of each DC Medicaid pharmacy provider so that you can be allowed to process prescriptions for DC Medicaid patients. Just a heads up, we did put a little grace period in because typically we would have stopped all prescriptions for DC Medicaid providers if they did not have the new license uploaded as of yesterday. So, but there's a grace period in. I'm not going to tell you how long it is, but it's not very long.
You
so
should have
sure
said
we had only because we were instructed not to let our DC Medicaid beneficiaries go without medications.
Yeah.
Because
okay.
Because
thank
of something
you.
That did not, there was no culpability on their part. But please make sure that you go to the website for the enrollment broker is www.dcpsandpeter.com, and also you can access it through our Magellan, who's our pharmacy benefit manager's webpage also. So you can do that as soon as possible, and I recommend that happen very soon, because you may find yourself in a position where claims for DC Medicaid fee-for-service beneficiaries will not be rejected.
Is this the first time that you're requiring that they
no,
use this broker upload?
Well, the broker
it?
Is new. The
okay.
broker function is new.
Okay.
Typically, they you would just fax a copy of the new license to DC Medicaid.
So now you just
but they have contracted with a broker now, which is called Maximus.
Okay.
And they're doing it on our behalf.
Okay, thank you for sharing that.
So a question. So this is for pharmacies that serve?
Right.
And so was there notification out to the pharmacies that they needed to renew?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, great. That's what you're, thank you.
Any other comments? Any comments, useful information you'd like to share? No? Okay. So we will entertain a motion to adjourn from someone.
So, Madam Chair, I move that the board close the open public session portion of the meeting and move into closed executive session portion of the meeting pursuant to DC official code for the following purposes: to discuss disciplinary matters pursuant to the code 2.575B9, to seek the advice of counsel to the board to preserve the attorney-client privilege, or to approve settlement agreements pursuant to 2-575B4.
Thank you. Is there a second?
Second.
All right. Is there a general consensus in favor of the motion?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
We'll do a roll call vote, starting with you, Tamar.
Yes.
You guys said your name.
Tamar McCants, and I vote yes.
Alan Friedman, yes.
Benjamin Miles, yes.
So this concludes the public open session of the meeting. The board will now move into the closed executive session portion of the meeting pursuant to DC official code 2-575B. for the reasons set forth in the motion. So thank you all. We are going to have a very brief break. I think we have a hearing that's scheduled. We have an appearance or something.
Next meeting is July 6th.
Okay. And our next open session meeting will be in August, the very first Thursday in August, and we hope to see you then.
Always to June.
Thank you.
I was thinking we're still in May.
No. That was yesterday.
Yeah.
I don't want everybody showing up.
August, right.
Did have some more information compared to this.
Yeah, because
it has some details about
the
school.
Ellen, do you have a second?
I know.
I took an Uber today.
So still there for the students.
So you guys can see that.
I do look.
Oh, so jealous. Oh, that's true. Okay. I'll have to hit you up Friday.
I'm going to go with you. Actually, yeah, let me just tell.
So when do you go to
Those are two children. Those are answers that you were told never to give. Always and never. You gave them. They're definitely the joy when they start singing.
Downtown Silver Spring, I think.
Just say when.
Good.
So she's going to
get to meet you.
That's the wife.
Yes.
This is the little.
You know her?
So this is the story. One of my friends took the time because she's
I can see that. He spent a long time talking about it.
She's an HSC. So she took the time to actually try to figure it all out. So the first question, how do you think you ask? It seems like they should be asking
colleagues.
This is the state.
Okay. So do you think that we need to have
I was on the phone with her while she was working on her, and I had some
I didn't even go on the website.
Okay.
But I also wanted to change the photo, and I have a passport size photo. Do I go downstairs? Where do I go downstairs?
You go downstairs on the first floor as you come out.
Just come out the right. And they can check to see whether, because usually I get my stuff back pretty quickly.
I was going to see if, because I don't have access to my system here, but we can check online.
Okay, yeah, I just had meant to do that.
Just to be sure.
Money, and I got the I got my receipt back in February.
Okay, so license number.
Got the data.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm going to take a look at the stuff if you want.
Oh, yes, please. I'm excited. I'm excited. She's got something going for me. You got something going for me. I'll be on the
Good to meet you. Tracy Davis.
Tracy Davis. Yes.
We introduced yourself.
AmeriHealth.
Yes.
Okay.
Those
are my peeps. How the boys tomorrow?
They
as
are
cute
so
as
good.
They want to be.
They are.
So the oldest one is which?
He's 5. He's going to be 6 in October, and the youngest is going to be 3 in July.
So the oldest did kindergarten?
He's in, no, because his birthday is late, so he's in pre-K.
Okay.
2019.
So I'm not sure why. I'm telling you. Yeah.
It was just perfect.
Okay, so what you can do is you go downstairs and you know, you've never seen it. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And see if you can get your license.
Absolutely.
The change of.
I started to call you.
Okay, great.
But I didn't know how to do it.
So that I know when it's
right. So since you signed in, your name should be on the.
Unless it just got lost in the mail or something crazy like that.
But you didn't have a preferred mailing address to go to a business or anything.
Yeah, I'm excited.
They will also look so that they can confirm your address.
Yeah, I wouldn't have sent it to the business. So unless someone thought that that's where they I wanted it to go.
Well, what they're going to do, they're going to look in the system and see they're going to confirm your address, and they're going to look at the business address, make sure you have been preferred to go to that address. If not, it'll go to as a
I'm going back to my office now.
Yeah.
Well, you know what?
Right. So they can look in there and see exactly what's going on, and then they can assist you in order to get that.
All the meetings related to this.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Dr. McCain?
Yes.
Have a great
day. I'm teleworking today.
Okay, good. I'm glad you were able to make it.
And I'm going to send you an email on something I asked you to help me with. I'm just going to send you an update on where I am in that process.
Okay, that would be great. I'm excited. I'm excited for everything you got going on.
You too. Keep me safe.
All right, have a good one.
Okay, I'm gonna make me kind of work.
Yeah, no,
because
I'm at 9:30.
That's right. Being work on time, I'm gonna
have to
work
tomorrow. No, she knows.
Oh, actually, I'm gonna do that from home.
Yeah. So just call me at 9:30.
Okay, I got it. Still a sweetheart. Because we have a thing tomorrow night for work from like 6 to 10 or something. Because I wasn't planning on coming downtown until like 11. Okay.
Yeah, that's right. She was. She was like, 7:30.